News that Kamala Harris will be Democrat candidate Joe Biden's running mate in November's US presidential election gives the front page picture story to both the Irish Independent and the Irish Times, where Suzanne Lynch writes from Washington that Joe Biden revealed Ms. Harris as his choice yesterday, ending months of speculation and following an intense selection process. There's never been a female vice president, and Ms. Harris is only the third woman from either major American political party to have her name on the ticket. And if they win, the 55-year-old senator from California will make history as the first black vice president. Elsewhere on the Independent's front page, Senna Maloney has the story that €240,000 worth of travel expenses was claimed by senators during the lockdown, despite the fact that the Shannon itself was closed for 90 days. Inside the paper, he lists details of 48 members of the upper house who still receive the benefits on top of their salaries of up to €68,000. The Irish News and the Belfast Telegraph both carry the story of Anna Sophia Gallagher, a 31-year-old Northern Irish woman who's been living and working in Beirut for the last 2 years. Speaking to Alan Preston in the Telegraph, she recounts how last Tuesday she was sitting outside a restaurant with a friend just a mile from the port when the devastating explosion happened. Recalling a moment of absolute total destruction, she describes how the buildings seemed to inhale and almost exhale and just spat out all of the contents. Details of the government's nine-month plan for dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic feature across the papers and give the Irish Times its lead. A new colour-coded system of status levels is being developed. It's envisaged as an instinctive system consisting of red, orange, yellow and blue statuses, but with status blue only possible when a vaccine or similarly effective medical breakthrough has happened. In the Irish Examiner, Michael Clifford reports on a data leak at the Department of Employment Affairs and Social Protection after the personal files of staff and former staff members were leaked through a data breach in one of the department's IT systems. On page 5 of the Irish Times, news that An Gcuartha Síochána may be reported to the Houses of the Oireachtas over a failure to increase the number of Gcuardaí who are able to carry out their duties through the Irish language in Gaeltacht regions. A report from An Commissioner Teanga Ronan O'Donnell, due to be published today, says it's especially regrettable that recommendations made by his office in 2011 have yet to be implemented. Under the headline Cattle Pen Concert, the Irish Daily Mail gives us a vision of what could be the future of outdoor live music, with photos of what's described as one of the world's first socially distanced pop concerts, which took place yesterday when singer Sam Fender played to a crowd of 2,500 people at Gosforth Park in Newcastle in England. Belfast legend Van Morrison is due to play there next month. The crowd at yesterday's gig was split up into 500 cattle pen style enclosures, which could hold a maximum of 5 people, with reporter Alex Ward writing that the venue looked more like a farmyard scene than a music venue. And finally, elsewhere, the Mail goes big on the much-hyped publication of Finding Freedom, the controversial new book about Britain's Prince Harry and his wife Meghan's strained relationship with the royal family. The publication of the book features across several papers this morning, with the Mail summarising with this cutting verdict on the book on page 1. The only winners from this heap of saccharine guff are the authors cashing in.
Meat factories have been central to the latest spike in COVID-19 cases here, around 300 in 4 factories in Kildare, Laois and Offaly. The outbreaks have focused attention on the working conditions in many of these factories. There are around 50 of them here with around 15,000 employees. They have come to the attention of the European Federation for Food, Agriculture and Tourism Trades Unions and we're joined now by its Deputy Secretary General Enrico Somalia. Enrico, you're very welcome to Morning Ireland. 80% of people who work in the meat factories here aren't Irish. Is there a reason so many people who come from other countries work in the meat factories?
Well, good morning, everybody, first of all. Yes, we can say that the sector highly depends on migrant workers and cross-border workers coming from within the EU and from third country nationals. But we can say that actually the situation is very critical, not only in Ireland, but also in other member states. And the reason why meat processing plants became vectors for the spread of COVID-19 actually needs to be found in the poor working, poor employment, and sometimes also the deplorable housing condition that a vast proportion of meat workers are facing nowadays in Europe. So exploitation in the sector is unfortunately long-standing and systemic, and that's why we really need immediate actions at national level, but also at European level. We really ask for an immediate response also from the European institution, because the problems are not only national, but also international and European.
Yes, and your organization compiled a report back in June on the situation of meat factories, and you included Ireland in that report. Let's look a little bit in more detail as to the working conditions. Many who work in meat factories are given work permits, and I think over 800 alone were given in the first part of this year here to people in Ireland. Do those permits tie the employee to the employer and make it difficult to leave?
Yes, actually, yes, and we can say that this is a condition that is quite recurrent also in other member states. So the condition of those workers is extremely vulnerable because their job is extremely precarious. Many of them live in overcrowded accommodation, sometimes to save cost or because the rent is connected or linked with their work contract. They work up to 16 hours per day, they get a very low pay, they suffer illegal wage deductions. So their condition of extremely precarious condition and the fact that their job is so insecure, makes them really vulnerable. And this, of course, is not helpful because they are scared, they are vulnerable, and therefore sometimes they don't report the symptoms that they may experience, and because of course they are afraid of losing their job. If in addition to this we consider the fact that sometimes they are not covered by sick pay, then you can understand what are the conditions in the sector.
You mentioned there illegal wage deductions. What is that? What deductions are made from employees' wages?
Well, according to our findings, what we are noticing is that in many countries, actually their accommodation costs are related to their work contract. So that means that in some countries, the employer is deducting accommodation costs, but also costs concerning working tools and other aspects. So if you consider that most of the time these workers just get the minimum wage, in addition to this there is a wage deduction, and in some countries these wage deductions are illegal, then you can understand that the situation of these workers is really problematic, and sometimes they really live in deep poverty.
Yes, and the cost of the work permits, which is expensive, is any of that deducted from the worker's salary?
Well, this depends really on the national situation and on the national context. The rules are not the same everywhere. Of course, having a high dependency on the employer, this is not certainly a positive aspect, because having such a high dependency determines the fact that they are not denouncing some of the time, they are not reporting the deplorable working condition that they are facing, and the cost of this work permit are certainly an additional negative aspect.
In what country, Enrico, are meat factory workers treated properly under employment law?
Well, we can say that we have good examples in the European Union, and these good examples most of the time are experienced in those countries where we have very good level of social dialogue, good collective bargaining agreements, industry level collective bargaining agreements that cover all workers in the sectors. So again, as usual, when employers and trade unions have a good relation, and when social dialogue and collective bargaining is strong, then at the end this is reflected in the positive working condition. We can see it in many countries, in many Nordic countries, for example, in Denmark, in Sweden, to a certain extent in Belgium as well.
Okay, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Morning Ireland. Enrico Somalia there from the European Federation for Food, Agriculture and Tourism Trades Unions. History has been made in the United States. The first woman of colour has been nominated for the role of vice president. The Democratic Party candidate Joe Biden has picked California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate. They'll make their first joint appearance later today. Our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan told me why Senator Harris had been chosen.
In a tweet announcing his vice presidential pick, Joe Biden described Kamala Harris as a fearless fighter. And Joe Biden would know because he has felt the brunt of that fighting spirit himself during the Democratic primaries. At the first Democratic debate, Kamala Harris, who was also seeking the party's nomination, very much went after Joe Biden, very much went on the attack and criticised him over his record on race. And when the two shook hands before the next debate, Joe Biden actually said to her, "Go easy on me, kid." Now, a running mate should help the campaign and make up for any gaps or deficits that the presidential candidate may have. And as we know, Joe Biden is not the strongest debater or the strongest media performer, but now he has this fearless fighter in the form of Kamala Harris in his corner. She's an aggressive, effective questioner during these Senate hearings that we see all the time on Capitol Hill. This is something, no doubt, that she's learned from her years as a prosecutor. She's a very strong debater. She's a strong media performer. She's tough, and she will need to be tough over the coming weeks, because when you're up against Donald Trump and his campaign, it's going to be a grueling couple of weeks and months as we approach Election Day. Of course, because of Joe Biden's age, there's lots of speculation out there that if he wins in November, he will only be a one-term president and won't run again in 2024. That means Kamala Harris could be getting ready for the top job in the Oval Office far sooner than her previous vice presidents.
So it's a pretty impressive selection in terms of historical significances, Brian.
Absolutely. Kamala Harris has been the favourite all along, really, in this process, certainly in recent weeks and months, but that does not undermine the fact that this is very significant, very historical. Back in 2016, Kamala Harris became only the second ever black woman to be elected to the US Senate. She has now become the first black woman to be chosen for a presidential ticket. For months, Joe Biden had said he would choose a woman as his running mate. Now, he never said it would be a black woman, but there were growing calls for that to happen following the recent wave of racial unrest we've seen here in the US and the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement. The campaign, of course, would be hoping that Kamala Harris would help boost support for Joe Biden among the African American community. But there is a general belief out there that vice presidential candidates don't necessarily bring huge benefits or lots of votes, but they can do a lot of damage to a campaign if things go wrong. Now, Kamala Harris, like all politicians, isn't perfect. She has had lots of her own issues. She failed in her bid for the Democratic nomination, and there was a sense that she wasn't able to articulate her positions on key issues like healthcare. She was also attacked over her time as a prosecutor in California. The liberal left side of the Democratic Party said she was far too tough on crime. Many members of the African American community criticized her for not doing enough to investigate things like police shootings and wrongful convictions and of failing to bring about reform. In recent months, however, following the killing of George Floyd, Kamala Harris has been leading calls for racial justice and police reform.
Will her selection ignite Republicans, Brian?
Well, it's been interesting to see the reaction of Republicans, and particularly the reaction of Donald Trump and his campaign. To be honest with you, Audrey, I think the reaction and the messages have been a bit mixed. Kamala Harris, as I said, has been the favourite to become Joe Biden's running mate for some time now, so it shouldn't have come as a great surprise to Donald Trump and his campaign. His campaign team did have an attack ad ready to go as soon as the announcement was made. But again, it was a bit disjointed. It said Kamala Harris was a phony who had flip-flopped on issues and was now embracing the radical left. But as I mentioned earlier, that progressive left wing of the Democratic Party isn't that mad about Kamala Harris and has concerns about her because of this history of hers as a tough prosecutor. I think right now for the Trump campaign, they don't know exactly what to do with Kamala Harris or how to attack her. Is she pro-police? Is she anti-police? Is she radical left? Is she more on the right? The fact that she's seen as someone who was tough on crime as a prosecutor, I think very much jars with Donald Trump's efforts to portray himself as the president of law and order. And of course, as a black woman, she'll appeal to many of the voters that Donald Trump will struggle to attract on Election Day. Now, Donald Trump was asked about Kamala Harris at his press briefing last night. And again, here I felt the messaging was a bit disjointed. He was a bit rambling about her. He was a bit all over the place. He said he was surprised that Joe Biden had chosen her. And he said that Kamala Harris was a liberal who would raise taxes. He described her as nasty. He said she'd been disrespectful to Joe Biden and disrespectful to Donald Trump's Supreme Court pick, Brett Kavanaugh.
She was extraordinarily nasty to Kavanaugh, Judge Kavanaugh then, now Justice Kavanaugh. She was nasty to a level that was just a horrible thing, the way she was, the way she treated now Justice Kavanaugh. And I won't forget that soon. I thought she was the meanest, the most horrible, most disrespectful of anybody in the U.S. Senate.
That was President Donald Trump ending that report from Washington by Brian O'Donovan. It's 25 past seven.
Now, it's every parent's worst nightmare that their child will become seriously ill with cancer. And when it happens, those weeks and months are filled with hospital appointments and treatments in the hope that they'll get better. And perhaps little or no time is given to the longer term effects of the cancer. And one of these is fertility. In many cases, children who recover can't have their own children in later life. So today, the Irish Cancer Society and the Marian Fertility Clinic are coming together to offer children the chance to have their own family in the years ahead. We'll hear more of that in a moment. But first, Olivia and Daniel O'Connell's 17-year-old son Dylan was diagnosed with lymphoma in February. He went through four rounds of chemotherapy to eliminate 22 tumours around his body, and their consultant recommended they try and preserve Dylan's fertility. Olivia says it has brought peace of mind.
In February 2019, Daniel and I heard the words no parent or anybody wants to hear. Our eldest son was diagnosed with stage 2A classic Hodgkin's lymphoma, and he would need chemotherapy and radiotherapy to rectify this awful disease. To say our lives were turned upside down is an understatement and will never be the same again. In early March 2019, we met with his oncologist, Michael Capra. For the first time, Michael recommended that my son should attend Marian Fertility Clinic as a precaution in case chemotherapy should reduce chances of a natural conception down the road. This seemed so surreal, but made complete sense. We took the advice given to us. It was possibly the best decision we could have ever made. We all know, as Daniel, myself, and our son, that down the road, when the time comes, please God, he's ready to build a family, we know that there's a plan B.
Well, we're joined now by Professor Mary Wingfield, who's the clinical director at Marian Fertility and a consultant gynecologist at Hollis Street Hospital. Professor Wingfield, good morning to you.
Good morning.
This new project is called Childhood Cancer Fertility Project. How will it work?
Well, I suppose we're absolutely delighted to have this funding from the Irish Cancer Society. We've got funding over 3 years to develop a national cryopreservation or freezing service for fertility preservation. As the previous speaker said, Olivia, this really gives hope to children and with cancer and their families. For boys, so we'll be able to offer services to a number of different young people. So for boys who have passed puberty, we've been providing sperm freezing free of charge for the last 2 years at Marian Fertility Clinic, and this grant will now enable us to continue that. We've also funded one or two cases for girls to freeze eggs. Freezing eggs is more complicated than freezing sperm and it's more expensive. So this grant will enable us to do that for girls who have reached puberty. So young teenagers, 14, 15, who would be suitable for egg freezing treatment. We also have funding to set up a clinic for adolescents and young people who have previously had treatment and who didn't have the opportunity to freeze their eggs or sperm prior to their treatment. So we'll be able to see these, particularly girls, at our clinic in Hollis Street and Marian Fertility Clinic. And we'll be able to do a full fertility assessment for them, because these girls are understandably concerned about their fertility in the future. And some of them may not have been affected by the chemotherapy, and that would be great if we can test them and reassure them that their fertility is okay. Others may have reduced fertility because the chemotherapy particularly damages their ovaries. And in some of these young women, they will eventually develop early menopause, maybe in their late 20s. And I suppose our hope is that we will catch some of these women, young women, in, you know, between 17 and 24, and maybe give them the opportunity to freeze eggs at that stage before they enter early menopause.
Okay. I think the plan long-term
then... For younger children...
Sorry, Professor.
Sorry?
Just a little tight for time. I think the plan long-term then is for younger girls to have their ovaries frozen. What are the benefits of that treatment as distinct from what you mentioned there?
So for young girls who haven't reached puberty, the only thing that can be done at the moment is to freeze ovarian tissue, so to take out an ovary and freeze it. This isn't available in Ireland at the moment because you need a very high quality laboratory and storage facility for the tissue. So again, this grant funding is going to enable us to try to set that up in Ireland over the next 3 years. So unfortunately, this will take a little bit of time, and we may have an interim arrangement where we can transport the tissue to the UK. But certainly, you know, this funding is going to enable us to develop that service, which is hugely needed in our country at the moment. We're one of the few countries in Europe that doesn't offer this. It's offered routinely in the UK. And I know of Irish patients who have needed to go to the UK for treatment for, say, bone marrow transplants. And it's not just cancer patients, other patients who have immune system disorders, other young people and children. And some of them have gone for transplants in the UK, where if they had been UK children, they would have had tissue frozen, but because they're from Ireland, they didn't.
Okay.
So there's a lot of injustice there, and we're really very much behind the rest of Europe in this regard. So
okay.
this grant should definitely help us to get it on the map here in Ireland, and hopefully put a good case to government for funding it in the future.
Okay. Professor Mary Wingfield, thank you for your time this morning. Positive news there for people who really do need some positive news.
The UK has officially fallen into recession for the first time in 11 years due to the economic impact of COVID-19. The pandemic sent the UK economy plunging by a record 20% between April and June. Global nutrition group Glanbia has reported a 2.3% increase in wholly owned revenues to €1.8 billion for its financial half year. Chief Executive Siobhan Talbot credited Glanbia employees and suppliers for ensuring all group activities continued throughout the six-month period. A new €12 million fund for enterprise centres has been announced this morning. Enterprise centres provide space, training, advice and administer grants to hundreds of companies and entrepreneurs throughout the country. The fund will be administered by Enterprise Ireland. On the currencies, €1 buys 90 pence sterling and $1 17 cents.
7:36, we say good morning to Darren Frehill.
Good morning, Louise. Dundalk got back to winning ways with a 1-0 victory over Waterford. They book a place in the last 16 of the extra.ie FAI Cup. Sean Hoare scored the only goal of the game. It came in the 17th minute. So a big win for Dundalk coming off the back of two really poor league games. The Waterford boss, John Sheridan, though, is turning his attention to another meeting between the sides on Friday. He's been speaking with our soccer correspondent, Tony O'Donoghue.
First and foremost, is our priority is to stay in the league, obviously. We don't want to be getting involved in any relegation scrap, but we wanted to do well in the cup as well. I've come here, I felt it was an opportunity to give one or two people who haven't featured too much a game. I didn't think we started the game really well. They get the goal, and obviously that advantage of getting a goal. But I'm really pleased the way we fought to try and get something out of the game. I thought we competed and we matched them in the second half especially, so we were pushing to try and get the goal to get us on level terms. So they're a good team, and you know, on a tricky pitch, they're strong outfit here. So, but I really do feel we competed well, so I look forward to it. It'll be another tough game on Friday, but we're going to come with a bit of confidence and hopefully try and get something from the game.
How disappointed were you to concede from a set piece though?
Yeah, very poor goal. I don't think we shouldn't be conceding a free kick. There was no danger, and the lad's got a free header in the middle of the box. There should be someone competing, but it's not to be. The response was really good, and obviously disappointed to lose, but the response and the fight from the players was excellent.
And we'll hear from Vinnie Perth, the Dundalk manager, in the next hour here on the programme. Massive week for Dundalk, who of course are in European action next week. Now, 18-year-old Ricardo Doninga scored an absolutely brilliant individual goal deep in extra time, injury time, to seal a 1-0 win for Cork City last night against Longford Town. Looked like this game was heading to penalties, but up he pops with a terrific individual effort. Worth checking out if you haven't seen it already. It's up on the Soccer Republic social media channel, so have a look. Fantastic effort. The second round draw will be made at noon today, and it'll be carried live on the FAI Facebook page. Now, Sevilla beat Wolves 1-0 to progress to the semi-finals of the Europa League. The goal came late on, just 2 minutes from the end of normal time, in fact, but a deserved victory, I think, over the whole course of the game. That victory sets up a last four date with Manchester United. Shakhtar Donetsk overcame Basel 4-1, and they'll meet Inter Milan in the other semi-final. In Gaelic games, RTE analyst Kevin McStay says he's not sure an inter-county championship will be viable for some counties. He was speaking on Game On last night. McStay said he feels some counties have some big calls to make.
Well, you take Leitrim, for instance. They would be spending for three matches, probably, two National League games, and possibly beaten in the first round of the championship. You know, that has been their recent history in the championship. They will be spending a lot of money just to play three matches, and that will be reflected among a lot of the weaker counties in the country. And then you also quoted, you know, the wisest of wise owls, John Prenti, a very long-serving administrator in the GA who doesn't miss too many bounces of the ball, I can tell you, Marie. And when he's talking about this thing being, well, you know, certainly heading towards the 50-50 region, well, you have to sit up and take notice. It is, I won't say it's on a knife edge. We have to wait and see. But the last week or two, it doesn't bode well for an inter-county scene. We'll do very well to get the club scene out of the way and see where we are then.
Time will tell. Serena Williams made a comeback to tennis last night. She beat Bernarda Pera in her first match in 6 months at the Top Seed Open in Kentucky. She plans on playing the US at the French Opens later this year. Finally, Ronnie O'Sullivan came from behind to beat Mark Williams 13-10 to reach the World Cup semi-finals. Mark Selby, Anthony McGill and Karen Wilson have also qualified for the last four. More sport in an hour.
There was some surprise, even astonishment last week when Russia announced it was to begin a mass coronavirus vaccination program across the country in October with its own newly developed vaccine. The US, the UK and China were considered the front runners. President Vladimir Putin has now announced that the vaccine has been given regulatory approval in Russia. It was effective, he said, and produced strong immunity. One of his daughters had been given a shot. Dr. Kleena Nikhali is consultant in infectious diseases and who also works in the immunology department in St. James's Hospital in Dublin. Dr. Nikhali, you're welcome. What do you make of this announcement by Russia?
Well, it's very surprising. We hadn't seen publications of, as we would expect, along the line of vaccine development. And then the fact that they've skipped the entire phase three, where they would test the vaccine on large numbers of people to make sure that it's safe and that it actually works. They've skipped that and gone straight for use. So it's not the normal pathway, and it's not something that we would consider safe.
I think they're planning on starting phase three of the trials, which involves, as you say, testing tens of thousands of people. Why is that so essential?
So it's essential for two reasons. So firstly, it's important to make sure that the vaccine is safe. So you test it first in a small number of people. That would be a phase two trial to test that it's safe. But you won't pick up rarer side effects with that small number of people. So you need to do a larger number of people and follow them very carefully to make sure that you pick up any rare side effects from the vaccine. And secondly, when you're testing that vaccines work, you can do that in a number of ways. One of them is looking at antibodies and things like that in blood from people who've been vaccinated. But the only real way to make sure that it works is to see that people are protected from getting coronavirus infection and disease. And they haven't done that yet with the numbers that they have tested.
And as you say, normally in these situations, details of the trials and the results are published, but that hasn't happened in this instance. And that's important because of peer reviews, isn't it? Hi, Kleena, can you hear us?
It's important because of peer reviews, and it means that you get extra pairs of eyes, independent pairs of eyes. I can, yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Sorry, there's a delay in the old line again. It's our greatest enemy on this programme. Go ahead, Kleena, thank you.
Okay. Sorry, remind me of your question.
Peer review and how important
that is. So normally it would be published in journals, so the scientists, yeah. So that scientists working in other groups, in other places, can see what you're doing. It's an extra pair of eyes, an independent of pair of eyes looking at what you're doing. And then it also means that science as a whole moves on, that we all learn from what each other is doing. And the fact that that hasn't been done in this case is very not normal and worrying in terms of we don't really know what they've done so far, what the results have been.
Does the World Health Organization have to approve every vaccine? Because it certainly hasn't approved this one.
No, it doesn't. So each country, or for example, in the EU, there would be a regulatory process. So the WHO doesn't have a role necessarily in approving a vaccine, but to skip, to bypass that mechanism and to bypass the usual kind of international ways in which we work on this type of vaccine development are unusual.
Is it a totally new vaccine that the Russians have come up with?
So it's a new way of doing vaccines in terms of using a virus, another virus, to carry little tiny bits of coronavirus into cells to trick the immune system into learning how to fight the virus. So the coronavirus is a little bit different to many other vaccines that we have, where we're vaccinating against infections that would normally give lifelong protection after you're infected. So for example, you have the measles naturally, you know, you get infected and you're usually protected from measles lifelong. So all the vaccine needs to do is really to mimic that normal natural infection. With coronaviruses, with the ones that circulate and cause colds, the much milder ones, you don't stay immune. So you can get a cold with a coronavirus this winter, and you can still get another one with the same coronavirus next winter. So we need to trick our immune system into doing something different to how it would normally respond to this type of virus. And how that's done in this case is by using another virus to kind of like a Trojan horse to carry bits of coronavirus into cells. And that's a new type using this particular vaccine. Hasn't been done widely, and obviously then has additional safety concerns because it's a new type of vaccine.
Okay, they're calling it Sputnik 5. Perhaps a degree of vaccine nationalism in evidence there. Cliona, good to talk to you, and thank you very much. And thanks for bearing with us this morning, Dr. Cliona Nicali there from the Immunology Department at St. James's Hospital in Dublin.
Well, there's been good news for anglers this summer. Reports of an increase in the numbers of salmon and sea trout. They're both endangered, and many rivers are closed to fishing across the country. But a big rise in catches is being reported in some fisheries. Alan Maloney is owner of the Mount Falcon Hotel in County Mayo, of course situated on the River Moy. He spoke to our reporter Amy Niriadha last night.
We haven't, since 2007, which was the first year that the drift nets were removed off the access points to the rivers of Ireland, we saw a dramatic increase in that year, 2007, but not anything like it since, until lo and behold, this year. And specifically our own experiences on the prolific River Moy. Over the last number of years, the average size of what we call grilse are the juvenile salmon that are returning from the North Atlantic for the first time during their life cycle. They are more plentiful in numbers typically, but the average size of the fish would be about 3.5 pounds in weight. That average has almost doubled. In other words, the size of the fish are in the region of 5 to 6 pounds. And they are in immaculate condition. Most of our normal anglers here at Mount Falcon, anyway, would typically be international guests. But obviously, given the COVID restrictions, they haven't been able to come here. So the other phenomenon is that we've had less fishermen, ironically, than we would ever have had. But therefore, the catch rate is considerably higher.
That's Alan Maloney speaking to Amy Niriadha there. Noel Carr, you're the National Secretary of the Federation of Irish Salmon and Sea Trout Anglers. Noel, what's going on in the rivers?
Yeah, well, Alan's right. We have seen a national increase, not just in the Moy, which is the jewel of the Irish rivers, but the over the 147 of those rivers, there's a number of marked increases, both in Donegal, Kerry, and down along the western coast as well. So we're welcoming it. It's nice to see something improving after, you know, we're talking 30 years of salmon conservation campaigns to try and get our government to actually try and improve the habitat enhancement schemes. And all those programs have been going on for the last number of years, especially the big thing, as Alan would have pointed out there, Louise, that the 2006 ban on the drift netting actually was introduced by the government of the time, and actually the minister now in charge is Eamon Ryan, who in actual fact implemented that ban at the time. So really, it's good to see it actually happening, but we're cautious with the as a result of this, because two reasons mainly. It's happening during a pandemic, so it coincides with that. And as Alan says, there's less people, less anglers fishing, but much more importantly, perhaps there isn't this high-level poaching that has occurred in past years, and we're seeing a result of that in the upsurge as well of the numbers.
Is it the case, Noel, that what's normally bad news for the rest of us, a bit of rain, is actually good news for anglers?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I mean, the conditions over the last past, this July, has actually been just an angler's dream, in the sense that the weather has actually given serious floods into the Spate rivers and allowed salmon conditions to... for salmon to return in the numbers that we are now seeing. And this is good, obviously, like, I mean, from an angling tourism point of view, it's excellent as well, because we're seeing returns that we haven't seen for, you know, 10, 15 years. But the most important thing, really, that is we attribute the increase to at the moment is the what's going on in the North Atlantic. Like, I mean, the habitat for the wild Atlantic salmon extends right out into the wild Atlantic, not just the Irish rivers and the natal rivers, but it's where, in actual fact, there is an agreement in place since 2018, a new agreement with the North Atlantic Salmon Fund and the Atlantic Salmon Fund, with the fishermen of the Faroes and the Greenlanders, which means, really, they have a deal that they allow the salmon not to be fished, to be protected in the feeding grounds, so that they return back to the Irish and the European rivers and the American rivers in greater numbers. Now, this is working after a 30-year program, really, but most importantly, the one since 2018. And we're delighted to see a result from that, which would be the third season.
And it is great that there's a bit of good news along the rivers. Listen, Noel Carroll, we have to leave it there for now. Thank you for joining us. It is 7:52.
Schools are preparing to reopen safely at the end of this month, and lots of businesses are helping them to do just that. I visited one such company, Zimmer Biomet, in Shannon, County Clare, which makes orthopaedic medical devices. I spoke to site leader Claude Costello.
As part of our corporate social responsibility, we want to do something for the community, and in particular for the schools. So our motto, our philosophy as a business, is made as if intended for my family. So all our orthopaedic implants are manufactured as if they would be manufactured for a member of your own family. And in July of this year, we were very conscious of the anxiety that was out there amongst parents and teachers and children about the reopening of the schools. So we wanted to do something to support and enable the safe reopening of those schools.
The company invited principals from 13 schools in Clare, Limerick and Galway to show them the measures that have been put in place at Zimmer Biomet and how they could adapt those measures in their schools.
They were delighted to see what good looks like in that type of situation. And, you know, while the measures we put in place are being deployed in an industrial environment, many of them are effective in any environment, and the school setting being no different. Before they left, we gave them what we called our Zimmer Biomet COVID-19 back to school safety pack, and what that included was some visual management systems, some signage, some floor tape and some sanitization dispensers that could be used in the schools to basically get them started.
Patrice Hayes is principal of St Aidan's National School, which has 260 children enrolled in Shannon, County Clare.
I jumped at the chance to go to Zimmer because my experience of Zimmer has led me to believe that they are innovative, creative and, quite frankly, have expertise in leadership. So I felt that anything that they had to offer would be worthwhile and would give us very practical advice. It got us thinking here in St Aidan's very logically and practically, because we have now started to think about entry and exit points, arrival and dismissal times, policy formation, and above all, communication.
They also provided safety packs. Has the department provided anything like that?
Not as yet. The Department of Education have suggested that they will supply us with hand sanitising equipment towards the end of August. One of the standout things that Zimmer Biomet have done is that they have created signage that is very, very child friendly. it's intended for the target audience, which obviously is children. And I think it was designed by 11-year-old Sive. And she deserves huge credit for that because it is very eye-catching.
Yes, I think children will understand it because it's very colourful and it has loads of cute animals on it.
Sive O'Donovan attends Crushing National School in Clare. She designed a sign with the 6 steps to stay safe at school.
Keeping a safe distance, covering your mouth when you sneeze or cough, wash your hands regularly, use your own pens and pencils, do not shake hands or hug, and tell your teacher if you feel sick.
It's really important for private industry that schools reopen again. Claude Costello from Zimmer Biomet explains why.
It's the schools and the Turtle Level Institutes that's providing the pipeline of talent that's going to allow us to reopen and grow all the businesses in Ireland and grow Zimmer Biomet as a business, but also to use that talent to grow the economy. So I think it's essential that the private sector get involved in initiatives like this.
I'm very confident to open St Aidan's. I mean, we have here in St Aidan's taken every practical measure that we believe that we could have to date. We have a fantastic support network in our parents, our board of management and the staff. So together I think that we can and will open St Aidan's safely on the 31st of August, and please God that we will all stay safe.
I'm looking forward to go back to see my teachers and my friends, and I miss playing in the yard.
11-year-old Sive O'Donovan there, looking forward to going back to school. I'll have more at 8:30. Audrey.
It's time for the weather forecast. Paul Downes is at Met Éireann. Morning, Paul.
Good morning. Well, it's a cloudy start to the day with some lingering mist and fog patches. That should clear off this morning, leaving a mostly dry day with good sunny spells. However, a few showers are possible in the southeast this evening. It'll be warm and humid, especially in Munster, with top temperatures of 19 to 26 degrees in light northerly or variable breezes. There is risk of heavier thundery showers tonight, mostly over the south of the country. It'll be a warm and close one, with overnight temperatures dropping no lower than 12 to 17 degrees. Some mist and fog patches will develop again in light to moderate northerly breezes. Thursday will start off mostly cloudy, with showers, some heavier thundery at times, especially in the south. Occasional bright spells will develop elsewhere. Remaining warm at highs of 19 to 25 degrees in light to moderate northeast to easterly breezes. Friday will be mostly cloudy, with continued risk of showers in the south and highs of 19 to 23 degrees, with a similar warm but showery picture for the weekend. If you're out enjoying the sun, please remember to adhere to HSC guidelines controlling the spread of COVID-19. Don't forget your sunscreen and have a great day.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, August the 12th, and this is Morning Ireland with Louise Byrne and Audrey Carville. The news is read by Susan Jackson.
In the United States, the Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden has announced Kamala Harris as his running mate in the November election. Ahead of his formal acceptance of the nomination next week, Mr. Biden said the California senator was a fearless fighter and someone he was proud to have as his partner in the campaign. Our Washington correspondent, Brian O'Donovan.
Back in 2016, California Senator Kamala Harris became only the second ever black woman to be elected to the U.S. Senate. She's now the first black woman on a U.S. presidential ticket. Announcing her as his running mate last night, Joe Biden said Kamala Harris had been a fearless fighter for the little guy and was someone he was proud to have as his partner in the campaign. She said she was honored to join Joe Biden on the ticket. The two will make their first joint appearance later today at an event in Delaware. Reacting to the announcement, the US President Donald Trump said Kamala Harris was nasty and disrespectful. His campaign released an attack ad describing her as a phony. Brian O'Donovan, RTE News, Washington.
The National Public Health Emergency Team will meet today to review the latest trends on COVID-19. Figures overnight show that the number of confirmed cases in hospital and in intensive care has reduced. Our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
Last night, the Department of Health reported one further death and 35 new cases of COVID-19. It's the lowest number of daily cases reported in 2 weeks. Most new cases are linked to outbreaks rather than community transmission. Also, new figures from the HSE show that the number of confirmed cases in hospital and in intensive care has reduced. There are now 11 confirmed cases in hospital, down from 14 yesterday. And 5 of these patients are in intensive care, a reduction of 2 on yesterday's figures. There are also 125 suspected cases of the virus in hospitals. The National Public Health Emergency Team will meet today to review the latest trends on COVID-19. Acting Chief Medical Officer Dr. Ronan Glynn said the number of cases is likely to rise and fall this week.
Employers will be entitled to a financial incentive of €3,000 to take on apprentices under a new scheme to be announced later today. The Minister for Higher Education and Innovation, Simon Harris, wants to expand the model to include more sectors of the economy as it recovers from COVID-19. Here's Mary Regan of our political staff.
Over 18,000 people are currently undertaking an apprenticeship across a wide range of occupations, from electrical, construction and engineering to healthcare, information technology and financial services, areas where Minister Harris would like to see the model expanded. He says it's an exciting option for people of different ages and backgrounds and for career changers as well as school leavers. He says he wants to see the numbers grow, and the government provided funding in the July stimulus package for this purpose. Today he will announce a €3,000 financial incentive for employers who've taken on apprentices between March and the end of the year. He says these apprentices will play a key part in Ireland's recovery and the country's future.
New Zealand has postponed the dissolution of Parliament ahead of a general election after new cases of coronavirus put the country's largest city, Auckland, back into lockdown. But the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, told a news conference that no decision had been made on whether to postpone the poll. The four new cases from a single family comprised the first outbreak by community transmission in more than 100 days. The source of the infection is still unknown, with no links to overseas travel. New Zealand's Director General of Health is Dr. Ashley Bloomfield.
We are working hard to put together the pieces of the puzzle about how this family became infected, and to contact trace anyone who may have had or been in contact with them. We're prepared to test tens of thousands of people in coming days so we can see if there are any more cases of COVID-19 in our community.
The European Union has said the Belarus presidential election, which returned the authoritarian president Alexander Lukashenko to office, has been neither free nor fair. The EU has threatened to impose sanctions on those responsible for violence, unjustified arrest and falsification of election results. More than 2,000 people have been detained and protests have continued in Belarus for a third night. Mr. Lukashenko's main challenger, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, has gone to neighbouring Lithuania. Two leading pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong have been freed on bail a day after they were arrested under the new national security law imposed by China. The media tycoon Jimmy Lai was the first to be released, followed by the campaigner Agnes Chow. Both were arrested on allegations of colluding with foreign forces, uttering seditious words and conspiracy to defraud. Ms. Chow, whose passport was seized by police, warned campaigners of the increased risks they face.
Over the years, I've been arrested four times in total. Of all of those arrests, to be honest, this has been the most frightening experience. So when I imagine that there will be other people from Hong Kong who find themselves facing a tougher and more painful situation than me, I know that it's a difficult choice to continue to walk this road in the fight for democracy.
And the time is just 6.5 minutes past eight.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Centra. Make the most of summer. We've everything you need at Centra.
Mist and fog may linger for a time this morning, but will clear gradually to leave a mainly dry day with sunny spells. A few showers are possible along southern coast by evening. Warm and humid with highest temperatures of 19 to 25 degrees, warmest in Munster.
As we've been hearing about in the bulletin, news that Kamala Harris will be Democrat candidate Joe Biden's running mate in November's US presidential election gives the front page picture story to both the Irish Independent and the Irish Times, where Suzanne Lynch writes from Washington that Joe Biden revealed Ms. Harris as his choice yesterday, ending months of speculation and following an intense selection process. Details of the government's nine-month plan for dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic feature across the papers and give the Irish Times its lead story. A new colour-coded system of status levels is being developed. It's envisaged as an instinctive system consisting of red, orange, yellow and blue statuses, with status blue only possible when a vaccine or similarly effective medical breakthrough has happened. Elsewhere, on the Independence front page, Senna Maloney has the story that €240,000 worth of travel expenses was claimed by senators during the lockdown, despite the fact that the Seanad itself was closed for 90 days. Inside the paper, he lists details of 48 members of the upper house who still received the benefits, on top of their salaries of up to €68,000. The Irish News and the Belfast Telegraph both carry the story of Anna Sophia Gallagher, a 31-year-old Northern Irish woman who's been living and working in Beirut for the last 2 years. Speaking to Alan Preston in the Telegraph, she recounts how last Tuesday she was sitting outside a restaurant with a friend just a mile from the port when the devastating explosion happened. Recalling a moment of absolute total destruction, she describes how the buildings seemed to inhale and almost exhale and just spat out all of the contents. On page one of the Irish Times, Harry McGee has the story that the pandemic has led to a €120 million overrun in the budget for direct provision. A briefing paper from the Department of Justice for Minister Helen McEntee says the department would have struggled to stay within budget even without the exacerbating effect of the pandemic. And both the Irish Daily Mail and the Irish Daily Mirror lead with Taoiseach Leo Varadkar's warning yesterday that there will be further outbreaks of COVID-19 when the schools return. Speaking to RTE Television's Open for Business, the Taoiseach said he couldn't give an absolute guarantee that schools would reopen in the new term. In the Irish Examiner, Mick Clifford reports on a data leak at the Department of Employment Affairs and Social Protection after the personal files of staff and former staff members were leaked through a data breach in one of the department's IT systems. The Mail goes big on the much-hyped publication of Finding Freedom, the controversial new book about Britain's Prince Harry and his wife Meghan's strained relationship with the royal family. The publication of the book features across several papers this morning, with the Mail summarising with this cutting verdict on the book on page one. The only winners from this heap of saccharine guff are the authors cashing in. And finally, in features, the Herald has the story of life coach Marianne Herron, who took up boxing at the age of 77. Marianne says the sport not only gives her a full body workout, it also keeps her mind sharp and is a lot of fun. Writing that she had fantasised about trying to box ever since she interviewed Barry McGuigan years ago, she has some tips about technique and mindset too, describing how boxing can be seen as the noble art of self-defense. If you don't get hit, you can't lose.
Red, orange, yellow and blue reports this morning that the government is considering a colour-coded response to coronavirus to replace the current phased approach. Taoiseach Micheál Martin said yesterday that a medium-term plan stretching into next spring is being worked on. We'll hear shortly from Health Minister Stephen Donnelly, but first Professor Mary Horgan, President of the Royal College of Physicians of Ireland, is on the line. Good morning, Mary. This is a reality check, isn't it, that we could have a very difficult winter ahead?
Yeah, I think it's advanced planning on behalf of the government, which is very welcome. The roadmap we had was rolled out in March. And I suppose a lot has happened between March and now. 5 months later, we have a huge amount of information on who gets the infection, who's most vulnerable, how we need to protect them, but also where outbreaks and clusters are happening and how we can suppress all that by doing very rapid, agile testing.
You think micro lockdowns is the way forward. What could that look like?
Well, this happens in other countries, and I suppose just to say that the importance of linking in with our European countries like Germany, who do this and learn from what really works from them, is really an important part of our way forward. So that would involve lockdowns where there are clusters. So what would happen there is public health linking in with business and the communities within areas so that there's an understanding of why the lockdown needs to happen, how long it's going to go on for. So rather than a broad brush lockdown of the whole country or indeed counties, that it really would be based on where clusters are. And that, you know, part of that would be an approach to regionalising the testing that we have here. I mean, testing, I've said from the very beginning, is absolutely fundamental in our ability to control that. And that's end-to-end testing from the point of taking a swab right through to the talented, very talented contact tracers and public health doctors we have who confine the infection. But the testing needs to be rapid. It needs to be agile. So it needs to go from maybe one sector in one county to another sector very, very quickly, so that we get rapid tests, rapid contact tracing, and thereby rapid containment of the infection, as has happened in the counties, given that the numbers thankfully seem to be on a downward trajectory.
This week, though, we had meat processors and a creche owner reporting delays in getting test results. That is a problem with the approach now we're heading into.
Well, I think this has been an opportunity to really test our systems. And if there's a delay, I think there's an onus on the HSE to go to look at the systems and see how they can increase rapidity. But one way of doing that is to regionalise the testing, either by various counties or various high-density populations, and see how you can make testing as accessible and easy as possible to access for everybody, because this is all about test, identify those who are infected, look after them, obviously, and contain the infection. And we need to be, and I'm quoting Paul Cullen, the Irish Times yesterday, we need to be hunters rather than the prey. We need to be proactive rather than reactive and passive. So let's try to get one step ahead of the virus all of the time so that we can contain it, because no country in the world has been able to eliminate that. And we've seen what's happened in New Zealand in the past few days, which is a testament to how infectious this virus is.
Can you shed any light, Professor Horgan, on where the lag or where the delay might be in the system? Because we're told the capacity is there, but yet anecdotally there seems to be some difficulties.
Well, it's hard for me to do that because I'm not involved in the public health response to it. But, you know, there is an opportunity to look at all of the, I suppose it's like a food chain, every single point of the testing, to see if there is, you know, a delay. Certainly I work in frontline in a hospital, and the turnaround in hospitals is very quick, but that's because the patient is in the hospital or the healthcare worker is in the hospital, and we can get the testing back very, very quickly. Which is very important for the health service to work to function normally. But like any chain, it's important to look at each element and see what areas can be improved, because a chain is as strong as its weakest link. And I've no doubt that with a national testing strategy and the ability of the HSE, who have built up huge capacity, and the expertise of contact tracing, that they will be able to do that and see how to even further improve the rapidity, but also the agility of testing, so that it can be scaled up and down very, very quickly.
Can you see the government doing what has happened in the Midlands again?
Well, I think they will learn a lot from what the outcome in the Midlands is. It's, you know, it's just week one of the 14-day lockdown that they have there. And I suppose following, and I think it's so important to look at all the information that they're going to gather in these 14 days, because obviously it's huge implications for the people of the three counties and the businesses, getting schools prepared for. And perhaps that multi-sectoral report, approach to how lockdowns will happen, even with micro-lockdowns, will be the way forward.
Okay, Professor Mary Horgan, we'll leave it there. Thank you for your time this morning.
We're going to talk now about the decision by Joe Biden in the United States to name Kamala Harris as his running mate, the first black woman and South Asian American in the role. Once a rival for the top job, the California senator of Indian Jamaican heritage had long been considered the front runner for the number two slot of vice president. We're going to discuss this now with Larry Donnelly, NUI Galway Law Lecturer and political commentator. And we're also joined by RTE's Jackie Fox, who is co-host and producer of RTE's States of Mind podcast about the US presidential election campaign. You're both welcome. Larry, first of all, was Kamala Harris always going to be the choice?
Yes, in my view, I strongly believe she would always be the choice, and I actually would have been stunned if she wasn't. I think the reality is she's telegenic, she's charismatic, she's probably best situated to drive African-American turnout, which is going to be extremely important in November, and also two X factors, I think, that were present. She's a known commodity. She's a safe pair of hands. The American people know her, and what's more, she was close to Joe Biden's son, And I think anyone who knows Joe Biden would say he prizes loyalty above all else and prizes the opinion of his family members. I think that intangible factor also probably swung things her way.
Jackie, will you tell us a little bit more about her? Who is Kamala Harris?
Yeah, I think a lot of people will be wondering who she is. I mean, her own parents were immigrants to the United States. Her father was from Jamaica, her mother from India, and their lives and her own have in some ways embodied that whole American dream. And she was born in Oakland in California, and she earned her undergraduate degree at the historically black Howard University in Washington. She's had a lot of firsts. She was the first black attorney general of California. She was the first woman to hold the post, and she was the first woman of South Asian heritage to be elected to the US Senate in November 2016. And as a senator, she has employed very tough questioning skills, honed as her time as a prosecutor, notably in particular during the Senate confirmation hearing of Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh. And there's a great quote of her going around online at the moment of what her mother used to say to her is that you may be the first to do many things, but make sure you're not the last.
Larry, how will she help Joe Biden win the White House? Will she help him win it?
I believe so. Again, African-Americans across the United States, I think she's the one who's best situated to move them. When it comes to the campaign trail, and I've said this before, Joe Biden is going to have to lean on her an awful lot. Kamala Harris is definitely up for the 24/7 rigors of campaigning. She's there. She's capable. Whereas Joe Biden, there are serious concerns about whether he will be able to do that. The other thing I think that she'll help with is with the vital constituency of suburban white women. I also think that they will warm to her story, as Jackie alluded to, and warm to her personally. And I actually think in that regard, her background in law enforcement, which has been criticized by some on the left, will reassure that block of voters, the key people that Biden needs to get on side, the people in the middle. Her background in law enforcement, I think, will be a positive, not a negative, because for those voters, defunding the police is not a very popular idea. And I think that she can simultaneously assuage those voters while pointing out to people of color and to people on the left that she was involved in some reform while she was in law enforcement. So in every respect, she makes sense and she ticks all the boxes.
She was critical, Jackie, of Joe Biden during the early debates in the US in the Democratic primary campaign, of which she was a part. She was the lead candidate for a while back then. Will she and Biden be able to put their own differences aside? They will have to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just even recent weeks and months, we've seen Black Lives Matter protests across the US since the killing of George Floyd, which has been highlighting racial injustice in the United States. But always for Kamala Harris, her heritage, her race, her identity, it's been a such important factor to her. For her, and before these protests even happened, she launched her campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday in January 2019. And it was attended by around 20,000 people in Oakland. We obviously know now that she would eventually drop out of the race, as you said there, Audrey. But a major highlight for her during that campaign was when she clashed with Joe Biden during the first Democratic debate, chiding the former senator over his opposition to the 1970s busing programs that forced integration of segregated schools. That provided her with a breakout moment and a bump in the polls, but it was also short-lived. And when she had that clash with Joe Biden on the debate stage, apparently his wife Jill was not very impressed with the senator at all. But it just shows that, you know, politics isn't personal, and what happens on the debate stage can be left there.
Well, let's hear that clash right now, Jackie. This is the moment when Senator Kamala Harris clashed with Joe Biden over that issue of busing.
Vice President Biden, do you agree today that you were wrong to oppose busing in America? Then?
No.
Do you agree?
I did not oppose busing in America. What I opposed is busing ordered by the Department of Education
That's what I opposed.
Well,
I
there
did
was
not
a failure of states to integrate public schools in America. I was part of the second class to integrate Berkeley, California public schools almost two decades after Brown v. Board of Education.
Because your city council made that decision. It was a local decision.
So that's where the federal government must step in. That's why we have the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. That's why we need to pass the Equality Act. That's why we need to pass the ERA, because are moments in history where states fail to preserve the civil rights of all people.
Arguing then, presenting a united front today, the presidential nominee and his vice presidential candidate there. Larry, one of the roles, I suppose, of the vice president is to get down and dirty with the opposition. And certainly Kamala Harris is assertive and tough in debates.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely the case. And just to jump back one second, the reality is that attack was politics. And I think anybody who saw Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush in the primary campaign in 1980 would have been astonished to see them present such a united front for 8 years. So that can be that can certainly be overcome. But certainly Kamala Harris is a formidable opponent. She's a formidable debater. But word is that she's also well-liked on Capitol Hill, that there are a lot of Republicans who do have respect for her. She is going to have to get down and dirty, as you say, to accomplish the agenda. She is going to be an activist vice president because of the presumptive nominee's age and related concerns about his capacity. She's ready to step in and do the job, and she has the energy and the vigor. And that's why, again, I would have been surprised if Biden chose anybody but her.
And Jackie, she will have to be ready for whatever Donald Trump throws at her.
Absolutely. I mean, Kamala Harris, she's young, she's 55, she's a seasoned politician. And that's important, too, because we did have one of the most diverse Democratic races in history. We had young, old, black, white, straight, gay, all vying for that nomination. But yet it seems the Democratic Party wants that seasoned politician in the form of Joe Biden, who was a six-term senator and former vice president, who they think can steady the ship after an unpredictable president in an uncertain year. And with the 77-year-old Mr. Biden expected to serve only one term if he is elected as president, Kamala Harris will be favored to win the Democratic presidential nomination in 4 years from now. And I know it's looking way into the future, but that could give her a shot at a more history-making as the first female president of the United States.
Well, to put it bluntly, Larry, today's Democratic Party does not look like Joe Biden, as Jackie alluded to there. And this is as important for the future of the Democratic Party as it is for his campaign, presumably.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of people, both in the United States and elsewhere, are still kind of reeling at the fact that the two nominees are white men in their 70s. So I think that the choice, again, was important on that front. The signal it sent to people of color in the United States that they are going to be represented in the very highest level of power. And this goes back to her very powerful backstory. I think there's also some tight wire walking here as well, because while she is a person of color, Harris has been part of the establishment. She has worked in law enforcement. All of those things, speaking ruthlessly politically, will not alienate those white voters, I suppose, in the middle, who are ultimately will decide this election, just like all presidential elections. So she'll do that, as well as, I think, energizing and invigorating people of color across the United States.
But Larry, is she a bit of a flip-flopper, as so many are, I suppose, because during the campaign, her own campaign, she moved from being a moderate to being a left, and now she's come back again. Will people wonder what her core values are?
That's a valid question, but I think that the key point is none of the choices were perfect. And if you look at her positions, and she has shifted on things like Medicare for All, for instance, it's arguably easier for Biden to work with her because she has been malleable to an extent than if, say, for instance, she had chosen somebody like Elizabeth Warren, with whom Biden has really strong and sincere policy differences. The fact that Harris has moved around a little bit makes it harder for Republicans to paint any real big disagreements between the two. So rather than that being a weakness, to some extent, it could be portrayed as a strength, that she is willing to compromise, that she does move a little bit. I think that ultimately might work to her advantage rather than to her disadvantage. And also, again, the key here is those voters in the middle. Democrats desperately do not want to alienate them.
Just briefly, Jackie, will this ignite the campaign?
Absolutely. I think, you know, in a world of COVID-19, we have the conventions over the next 2 weeks, the Democratic Convention and the Republican Convention, which look incredibly different compared to years gone by. There'll be no glitz, there'll be no glamour. Most of it will be done over Zoom. So this ignites a bit of drama into it. We've already seen Donald Trump calling Kamala Harris extraordinarily nasty. But as we know, even from that clip of her with Joe Biden, she has already shown on the debate stage that she is well able to tackle her opponents, and all eyes will be on her when she debates Vice President Mike Pence in October.
Great to have you both on the programme this morning. Jackie Fox of RTE's Foreign Desk and co-presenter of RTE's States of Mind podcast and law lecturer at NUI Galway and political commentator Larry Donnelly.
Petula's back now with business.
Thanks, Louise. The UK has officially fallen into recession for the first time in 11 years due to the economic impact of COVID-19. The pandemic sent the UK economy plunging by 20% between April and June. Earnings at global nutrition group Glanbia declined by 25% to €85 million. In its half-year results, the company reported a 2.3% increase in wholly owned revenues to €1.8 billion. Its global performance nutrition business was heavily impacted by COVID-19. Revenues at Hostelworld fell by 69% to €12 million in its first half year due to travel restrictions. Net bookings fell by 67%. A new €12 million fund for enterprise centres has been announced this morning. Enterprise centres provide space, training, advice and administer grants to hundreds of companies and entrepreneurs throughout the country. The fund will be administered by Enterprise Ireland. On the currencies, €1 buys 90 pence sterling and $1 17 cents.
8:36. Good morning again to Darren Frehill.
Good morning, Audrey. Well, Dundalk got back to winning ways last night with a 1-0 victory over Waterford. They're into the last 16 of the extra.ie FAI Cup. Sean Hoare with the only goal of the game popped up in the 17th minute to decide the match. Now, the sides will meet again on Friday and then a very big Champions League qualifier for Dundalk next week. Vinnie Perth, the Dundalk manager, has been telling our correspondent Tony Dunhue that he's confident the game against Celje will go ahead. There are doubts about it because there's been a suspension to the start of the Slovenian League. Now, more on that and how Dundalk themselves are looking after their own COVID-19 testing in a moment. But first, his thoughts on getting back to winning ways after two league results recently.
It's more like us. I thought we were much more intense in our play, your fullbacks getting on. It was more the Dundalk way. So it's a good building block. It's a good starting point for us, but that's all it is. I mean, we've got to back it up now on Friday, which will be a difficult game. Playing the team so close is difficult. But hopefully we get good practice out of that because it's really, really warm here and we have to play in a good bit of heat in Hungary next Wednesday. So hopefully it's a good learning curve for us.
What's the status of that game? Because we heard that the Slovenian League has had to be suspended or hasn't even restarted because of a new COVID outbreak.
Well, we were tested yesterday. The club made that decision to sort of reassure everybody in our own little bubble that we're clear. We had hoped that the FAI would continue to test, but obviously there isn't funding there. So we tested our own guys and we've got to test them 2-3 days out before the game. So I presume it's the same for the Slovenian lads. They've got to pass their all tests. We've got to pass theirs. And then we play in Hungary and I expect that's what's going to happen.
And do you feel tonight that you brought it up a level, getting closer to a Champions League level that you'll need?
Yeah, an interesting question, Tony, because that was the team of the week. We've got to start building towards a Champions League level. We're not there yet. You know, and I expected rustiness tonight from Sean Hoare, Brian Gartland, Dara Leahy. We expected that Will Patching. They haven't played games, so we rebuilt them. But it was a bit more closer to what's needed at that level we're going to be at. We're not there yet.
You have the same opposition on Friday, which is unusual, as you say, but they'll probably present a different challenge on Friday.
Yeah, they will. You see Michael O'Connor coming on tonight, and a bit more, not that they'd be more direct, but he certainly gives them a physical element to it. But I thought tonight, you know, full credit goes to our medical staff. When you look at Brian Gartland and Sean Hoare on his medial ligament in his knee, it's not muscular we're having problems with, it's just bad, bad luck. And 5 weeks ago, and he's back at that level and that intensity. So the medical staff here is European ready. I've got to get the rest of the club European ready now over the next week.
In the other game last night, 18-year-old Ricardo Dinanga scored an absolutely brilliant individual goal deep into extra time, injury time, to seal a 1-0 win for Cork City against Longford Town. Looked like that game was heading to penalties, but up he popped, and what a goal it was. Check it out on the Soccer Republic social media channels. The second round draw will be made at noon today. Sevilla have beaten Wolves 1-0. They're through to the semi-finals of the Europa League. The goal came late on. 2 minutes from the end of normal time, Wolves missed a penalty. But I think on the overall assessment of the game, the Spanish side probably deserve to go through. They'll play Manchester United in the semi-finals next week. Shakhtar Donetsk overcame Basel 4-1, and they'll meet Inter Milan in the other semi-final. Now, the current Longford champions, Killoo, have been handed a 48-week suspension arising from an unpaid fine of €750. The punishment handed down after the club failed to fulfil an under-16 final back in January. The club are appealing the decision. Serena Williams made her comeback in competitive tennis last night. She beat Bernarda Pera in her first match back in 6 months at the Top Seed Open in Kentucky. She plans on playing at the US and the French Opens later this year. Ronnie O'Sullivan came from behind to beat Mark Williams 13-10 to reach the World Championship semi-finals. Mark Selby, Anthony McGill and Kyron Wilson also through. Now, we featured a pretty extraordinary interview with Ronnie earlier this week. Well, a more mischievous effort from him last night. He feels he won't beat Mark Selby.
Performed a miracle, really. You know, if it wasn't for finding a way to, you know, get some numbers on the board, that gave me a chance. It maybe put a little bit of a dent in his momentum. It was like Tiger Woods' version of snooker in a way. You know, didn't find a fairway all day, but managed to make some chips and some putts.
We'll see how he gets on in that semi-final. Live Guinness Pro 14 Rugby returns to RTÉ Radio 1 the weekend after next. We've two live offerings for you. They're both behind closed doors at the Aviva Stadium. Saturday Sport will bring you Leinster and Munster, and then that'll be followed by Connacht against Ulster the next day on Sunday Sport. And it's been a testing time for the sport with all the uncertainty around the return to play, but Leinster flanker Rhys Ruddock has taken the time off to reflect on how fortunate he is to play the game.
Sometimes, like when you're in the midst of season after season and some long seasons, you know, you ups and downs and all that, you can kind of be a little bit ungrateful or just forget about how lucky you are. And what I suppose that period off just freshened up the body, freshened up the mind, and got everyone, you know, really excited about the job that we get to do, and putting best foot forward and competing with each other, and then competing against some of the best teams as well. So personally, yeah, I've definitely found I've got a new appreciation for the job that we get to do.
Yeah, and we're looking forward to those games already. That is all your sport for now. Louise.
We've had the phased roadmap to reopening. Well, next up is a medium-term plan the government says to take the country through the next 6 or 9 months of living with coronavirus. Minister for Health Stephen Donnelly is on the line. Minister, work begins next week on this plan. What's the idea?
Good morning, Louise. Well, actually, there's been an awful lot of work done on the plan already. So NPHET have spent a considerable amount of time looking at how we move from what has been, I think, a very successful piece of work to date, but which has been quite responsive in its nature, obviously, as we learn more and more about this virus, to trying to put something longer term in place. And NPHET's proposal essentially is a colour-coded system, which we would all recognise and be quite familiar with from weather warnings. And the idea is that we have a yellow level, which is where we would be at now in most of the country, but outside of the three countries, obviously, where there's restrictions in place. There'd be an orange level, which would be some version of what Laois, Kildare and Offaly have in place right now. A red level, which would be across the whole country and which we have all become very accustomed to, which is very much what the people of Auckland are dealing with at the moment. And then blue. Blue is the colour of vaccines in the medical world, and the idea of blue is that we wouldn't be fully clear of this, obviously, until we have a vaccine, until we can get back to our lives. There was some thinking at the start around green, that we would have now as green, but I think we all saw that there was some genuine confusion at Ireland's so-called green list. You know, whereas in fact, when you looked at those countries and you look at our own country, you'd say, well, we're not really green, obviously. You know, we're having to take an awful lot of measures ourselves. We're having to follow all the basic guidelines. The business community are still having to put up with an awful lot and so forth. So the idea is a color-coded system where we all in the country can see how we're doing, how the country's doing, how regions are doing, how our local areas are doing, and we can therefore plan ahead a bit more.
Okay. Minister, though, what's the difference between colors and phases? It's just a different name.
No, it's not. So the phases, Louise, is an idea where you're moving through a time period. So as we all saw, when the original roadmap came in, there was a timeline attached to it to say, look, these are the conditions we'll deal with now. The plan is that in 3 weeks or in 6 weeks, we'll move out of that. As we saw, then Cabinet had to make decisions to pause on moving to phase four. And then, very unfortunately, we had to pause again on things like the reopening of the pubs because of a research of the disease in the community. This is different to that. This basically says, no matter what day of the week it is, no matter what week it is, where are we at now? So are we at status yellow, which is what most of the country is at now? Or have things got to a point where the public health doctors have said, no, we need to move to orange, either across the country or in different regions? So really, the phases was about providing a timescale. And the current proposal from the public health doctors is this would be very much a colour-coded warning system to say, where are we at on any given day?
Okay, so it sounds like a nuanced, specific responses. But does that suggest that what's happening in Leash, Offaly and Kildare at the moment is too blunt an instrument?
I don't think so. I really believe that the measures that the public health doctors recommended for Kildare, Leash and Offaly are very nuanced, you know.
Would you see yourself introducing that type of measures again?
It's entirely possible. Yeah, I think what Leash, Kildare and Offaly have shown is just how quickly this virus can spread and the need for us to be able to react to it quickly. So Leash, Kildare and Offaly, if we hadn't reacted as quickly as we had, what the public health doctors would say is we wouldn't have seen the scale of this. It would have seeped into the community very quickly. Inevitably, it would have got into the nursing homes. It would have spread around the country. And actually, we could have been right back to the start again, having to impose really strict measures across the entire country. The idea is that by having the testing and tracing systems in place and by having a system like NPHET is proposing, we can move as quickly as possible and as locally as possible to try and contain the virus when we do see outbreaks.
Okay, well, so speed is of the essence then. We heard this week meat processors and a creche where there was an outbreak saying they had delays in getting their test results. Do we have the test capacity?
We do have the test capacity, but we are working closely with the teams who are doing the testing to make it quicker and quicker all of the time. So,
well, what's the delays?
Well, first of all, the turnaround times are pretty good, right? So the median turnaround time from a referral to somebody getting the test, getting their result, all of their close contacts being contacted and everybody being isolated as appropriate. The median time right now is 3.1 days, which is pretty good. However, we're looking very closely at what happened in the three counties. And while the testing and tracing system has been excellent, I think it's fair to say, there have been one or two issues which have been identified. So, for example, thanks to the great work of everyone in the country, we were down to about 20 positive tests a day. As a result of that, the operation was scaled back in terms of the number of people who you need. And these are clinical calls, remember, so you're pulling people off clinical work to do these. The number of people we had reduced. What we then saw was over a really short period of time, instead of it being 140 calls in a week, it was 140 calls in a day. And while the tests were still being processed and the negative test results were being brought back, the phone calls, which are clinical calls for the positive tests, they weren't happening as quickly some of them weren't happening as quickly as we would all like them to. So one of the things, for example, that was discussed yesterday at the Cabinet Subcommittee was having more people in place, including accepting that just like your ambulance service or just like your fire service, when these people are needed, by God, are they needed very quickly. But by the same token, then there will be times when the work isn't there, but you have to maintain the capacity of service to respond quickly.
So when the challenge was there, we didn't have people ready to make the calls.
Well, when the challenge was there, the teams got onto the ground very quickly. The testing was done. 491 positive test results came back in a very short period of time. The negative test results did get out. The one area where we had scaled back the operation and we didn't have the people for 2 or 3 days was in the clinical phone calls to those who were positive. And that's something we are going to remedy.
Okay. Yesterday, IBEC told us on the programme that while some of the food processing workers do get sick pay, others will have to rely on the PUP payment, or if they have to isolate, or if they have COVID. Are you happy the state will be paying the workers of meat plants?
I would be very happy that the state will be paying the PUP and any COVID-related sick payment. I absolutely will, because what we have to have is a situation where every worker, if they feel symptomatic, they can raise their hand to their employer or to a family member, but most importantly to the GP, get onto the GP and say, I have one of the symptoms. The GP will refer them for a test. The most important thing is that no one in our country feels, I can't do that because, well, if I'm out of work for 2 weeks, I won't be able to pay the bills. I won't be able to buy food for my children. So what I'm going to do is, you know, I'll take paracetamol or I'll try and suppress it. And I'll hope that it, you know, that it isn't COVID, that it's something else. We absolutely can't have that system. One of the facets of this, Louise, that the public health doctors have impressed upon me is just how quickly it can spread. You have a lot of asymptomatic carriers. So one of the things we found from the clusters in the meat plants is an awful lot of people who were asymptomatic. One person can go to work in good faith. They can be asymptomatic. They can be in work all day. By the time they leave their place of work, you might have 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 people infected.
Sure.
So we must have a situation where if anybody feels symptomatic, they can go straight to their GP without any fear of not being able to pay the bills.
There is some concern there over potential GDPR issues around widespread testing. Is legislation required to address some of those concerns?
Not to the best of my knowledge. I haven't heard that. If that is the case, it's certainly something we can look at very closely.
Is there a problem in terms of, you know, if I've been diagnosed with COVID, my employer's entitlement to know that?
No, I don't believe there is a. I don't believe there is a problem. If there is, we can iron it out. But certainly, in the first instance, the person themselves needs to be told. There may be an issue around ringing an employer and saying, by the way, you know, RTE, hey, Louise has tested positive. There may be issues there, but certainly at a minimum, we will want employers to know that there are outbreaks in their facilities, because obviously we'll want them to take action straight away. So if there are issues around identifying an individual, there are certainly things we can iron out. But in the first instance, the person needs to know, because the person needs to isolate themselves, and we need to immediately start the contact tracing with them. And hopefully if they have the app, that will help. And in the second instance, an employer will need to know that there is a case or cases in their workplace so they can act straight away.
Okay. The timeline now that we're looking at, though, is potentially 9 months living with coronavirus. People are worried, they're stressed, they're exhausted. Are you concerned about whether you can bring people with you on the next phase of this pandemic?
I'm not, because really the question is, am I concerned about the resilience and determination and strength of the Irish people? And I most certainly am not concerned about any of those things. The response to date has been nothing short of spectacular, and it has come at a heartbreaking cost in terms of loss of life, loss of health, loss of livelihoods. And we remain very, very strong. And these are not just warm words from a politician, Louise. If you look at the data, it tells us that. What it shows is that in spite of these very big clusters, which we're moving on quickly, that the level of community transmission, that's the transmission whereby we don't know where it comes from, and it's the bit that really worries the public health doctors. The level of community transmission in Ireland is very low. And there's only one reason it can be low, and that's because the vast majority of people in this country are following the guidelines set down by the public health doctors. Now, the reality is We could be looking at this for 9 months. We could be looking at it for 2 years. We don't know. It really depends on when a vaccine comes through. I think the role that government has to play is we have to make sure that we are fully open and transparent, that people have all of the information that they can get, that people understand that in areas like Laois Kildare and Offaly, that when these restrictions are being put in place, they're being put in place as quickly as possible, okay, and in as minimalist a way as possible and in as transparent way as possible to do one thing: to save lives and to save public health, to protect the nursing homes, to protect vulnerable people in the community, and by doing all of that, to protect the local economies, even though it does mean, unfortunately, it's not always pleasant in the very short term.
Okay, Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, thank you for joining us this morning. It's 8:55.
We're going to talk briefly, finally, this morning about the white-tailed eagle, which has made a remarkable comeback after 110 years of extinction. Eamon Mescal is project manager of the White-tailed Eagle Project of National Parks and Wildlife Service. Eamon, what happened over the weekend?
Well, what happened over the weekend, Audrey, we released four of the white-tailed eagle chicks into the wild. We got 10 over last June, and we had a successful release into the wild on the shores of Loch Derg last Sunday. And that was attended by our Minister, Malcolm Noonan, and the Norwegian Ambassador, Arnse Fullerser, as well.
And what are your hopes then will happen from here on in?
The hopes that will happen from here on in is that the eagle chicks that we released will integrate now into the greater countryside, into the wild, and they'll do what we expect to do is in 5 years' time, when they mature, they'll mate up and they'll nest and they'll form families in the wild and breed local national Irish chicks, like has happened before as a result of the phase one introduction, which we did in 2006.
Yes, because I think a homegrown white-tailed eagle produced her own chicks for the first time. Is that the case?
That was it. I mean, it's a long-term project. I mean, we got the chicks in from Norway, the eagle chicks in from Norway in 2006, 2010. They became mature, and now we have 10 breeding pairs. And as a result of that, the first homegrown chicks were born, eagle chicks were born this summer on the shores of Loch Derg.
What conclusions do you draw from all of this about what's happening, Eamon? Why is this important? Why does it matter?
Look, it's important from, number one, a conservation point of view. The National Parks and Wildlife Service have worked with a broad stream of organisations and groups and countries on this. So from that point of view, it's good. We worked well with the Norwegians. We're working well with the local landowners and farmers. And we have a steering group made up of the IFA, the tourism sector, the raptor groups. And it's everybody coming together to create this wonderful example of how a strong working partnership between National Parks and Wildlife Service and the local community can make a conservation project work.
Okay, well done, and the best of luck in the future as well. Eamon Mescal, thank you very much indeed. It's 2 minutes to 9.